use my axe! I'm hungry!
Hello and welcome to Get to Work, Hurley. I am back for an encore. I believe we're episode number 4 at this particular point. This time I have a very special guest. My agent, Hannah Bowman, has actually been chomping at the bit to get on to the podcast and talk about all things story structure because she's a huge story structure nerd. We had a rollicking conversation in which she spoils all of your favorite movies and TV shows. There will be spoilers here for Captain America Civil War, for Rogue One, for Galaxy Quest, for anything else that she possibly mentions. She's going to spoil it for you. This is apparently, as you will learn, because she's a huge opera fan. And in opera, you read the synopsis. They actually have it in there in the program book, and you read it before you start. Anyway, I will let her explain all of that to you. But in the meantime, we get off on a crazy adventure in all things wondrous as far as story structure goes. So if you are someone who is fascinated by the process of making stories, or who has been kind of banging your head on the ground or on the desk or on the floor like I do when it comes to story structure, I think you will really enjoy this talk with Hannah. I will see you again on the other side of the talk, and hope you enjoy. You know, I love working with you because you are very hands-on as far as editing goes. But not all agents are. And so
I know it's weird.
Yeah, I know you think that's weird, but it's very common. I mean, when I tell people the amount of editing that we do, they're like, what? I know several people, their agents don't read their manuscripts anymore. They just don't even read them.
Okay, I mean, I think that is actual agenting malpractice, but okay.
That was kind of my reaction. It's like, really? Like, well, why bother anymore? They're all contracted.
What are you paying them for?
For contract. Literally, they are paid to do the contract, and then they're done. And then they just kind of walk away. And I'm like, well, you know, it's not...
Hire a lawyer for that.
And I was going to say, yeah, because you are very much about nurturing, like, growing writers. Like, that seems to be your approach to it. So I'm curious, what appeals to you about the editing process, or what is your approach to editing and the agenting process?
I like that you use the word nurturing, although I don't necessarily think of myself as a nurturing person.
That was the nice word I came up with, Hannah.
I really like the thing about writing where you put your bleeding heart on the page. Mm. And I think there's something really powerful in putting the thing you care, like writing the thing you care the most about and going to the places that are the most painful, not necessarily because they're like places of trauma or anything like that, but the places where you are drawing on something that's so deep in like your own heart and soul that it's hard to talk about and hard to write down, and putting that on the page. What I love about working with writers from the like mentoring side as well as the editing side is when you get to that kind of magic moment of connection, which you can see, you know, sometimes it happens at the brainstorming stage, sometimes it happens later in the edits when it's like, yes, that's the heart of this book. That's the thing that you've been afraid to write down in this book, and that's what this book is about. And I think there's really something magical about that kind of intimacy. And I do use the word intimacy because I think the editorial relationship is a weirdly intimate one. Mm-hmm. Like, you spend so much time in somebody else's head when you're editing that it's like, I really know how you think. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a relationship that's not quite like anything else. That's like a very woo-woo answer.
It is a woo-woo answer, which is not really what I was expecting from you, because you're so like, you're so methodical. And that's always my interest in how you actually approach the story itself, because to me you feel so story driven, and you know you're going to this emotional place, which I think is very interesting. Because to me it feels like I don't want to say clockwork story, but it's very Hollywood script. There are certain high points, right? Like you
structure. It's very structure.
Structure,
yeah.
Is the word I'm looking for. Yes.
So it's true. It's true that I am I am also totally obsessed with structure. I am totally obsessed with story structure, and I have been for a really long time. I think these things kind of go together. Like, what I want is the really emotional heart of the story, but the way that, like, the way my brain works, the way you think about getting there is by figuring out how to build the structures around it, if that makes sense. Mm. The thing about good story structure, it is like Hollywood formulaic story structure. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with formulaic story structure if the tropes are really well done. Mm-hmm. But the thing about good story structure is that if it's well done and it's well written and the tropes are well executed, then it takes you to the emotional heart of the story. Like, that's what those tropes do if they're done well. And now that I'm on the spot, I am not going to be able to think of an example. But that's what the tropes do if they're done well, and that's what they're for. And you can absolutely tell when something has the tropes but not the heart. I go on this rant pretty frequently about competent script writing every time I go see a famous Marvel movie that was poorly written. Mm. Although I have to say Spider-Man was really good. I just saw Spider-Man, and it had a competent script.
Oh, that's good.
But,
yeah.
And I shouldn't just pick on Marvel, but a lot of the big blockbusters have what I think are not competent scripts. And what happens is all the events kind of happen, mm-hmm. but they're not using the structure of the story to really make you care about the emotional beats or the pain points that you really need to care about. So like Rogue One
was
a movie that I hated.
Yeah.
I know this is a minority opinion, but I hated it. And they admitted that they didn't write a script.
There was no script, Anna. Like, how is that possible? Yeah.
Ah. But it also, it didn't work because even though from, like, a surface level, you could look at it and be like, look, this has a three-act structure. All the things happen that are supposed to happen. But the structure wasn't going anywhere. It didn't have any goals, like, for the characters. It didn't ever push you to the emotional place that mattered. Mm-hmm. For me, when I think about structure, it is very much about plot structure, but it's not about, let's make sure that there's enough action happening, or whatever that is. The plot structure is always in the service of getting to this very woo-woo kind of, like, what's the thing that you're afraid to write place. And the structure is a way of actually making the story go there. Because the thing about the really, like, emotional heart of the story is that it's hard to put on paper. The structure is, like, it's very easy to back down from it. And I think we all, anybody who's ever written, like, has that temptation to back down from the scary thing. The plot structure helps you not do that, kind of. It helps you keep your story moving that direction so that things go the way they really have to.
And I think I talk, again, and Rogue One did this as well, and it's something, of course, as you know, I struggle with. It's that whole idea of these characters who are kind of drugged through a story, like stuff is happening around them, and they're just kind of reacting to it the whole time, and they have nothing emotionally invested in it. They have no real choices to make, and you can see it, you can feel it in the bigger movies, and of course in your own.
And if you want to have a story like Rogue One that's about how they're gonna die at the end, spoilers.
spoilers comes before you say the spoiler, Anna.
Well. But the whole point is, honestly, if that's what that movie's about, that needs to be telegraphed from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Like,
about sacrifices,
the movie is about
to be made, and
And how does this character, who doesn't care about this, become so committed that she's willing to die for this cause? Mm-hmm. Because what happened is, they never made that connection. And so she made some choices. She made this choice to stay and die at the end, but none of it was set up. They never made that connection. And that's why that's where I come back to structure, is it's like, what's happening in the meantime? What's the gradual progression? What are the moments on this character's journey that are bringing them to this terrible, terrible place, right? Where they can make kind of the choice that they ultimately have to make. Mm-hmm. And that's the very, like, classical epic structure, is what are all these things bringing this character to this point? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, it's a plot that's in service to the character, as opposed to a character who's in service to the plot.
Right.
Yeah.
The plot is always in service to the character, right? And to getting the characters to that really deeply emotional place. And sorry, now I'm getting all distracted because I'm thinking about the Billy Joel song Leningrad, because I had, you know, and now we come into this place, and anyway, it's a great song, but it's very much actually what we're talking about. It's about these you know, the Soviet clown and Billy Joel and how they grow up and how they're different and what eventually brings them to this place where they're friends. And I can't think about the song without crying, so I shouldn't. But because I'll just get distracted. But I actually think it's a good example of, like, how do you structure, you know, in a 4-minute song, he's written a story that makes me cry every single time, mm-hmm. unlike many movies.
Yeah, I know many films where you go, well, that happened, and you forget about it completely afterwards.
And it's usually lack of commitment also. Like, so another popular movie that I really hated was Captain America, the Winter Soldier. Yes.
There will be spoilers for this one as well.
Should I tell people that? You should tell people that.
Anytime Hannah talks, there's spoilers. Okay,
It's probably going to be spoilers for your unwritten book if I'm not careful here.
I know, yeah. You gotta be-
so, but the thing that really made me angry in Winter Soldier is they start talking, they go down this, like, maybe S.H.I.E.L.D. is fascist road, mm-hmm. which I totally agree with. I hate S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D. is so fascist. Mm-hmm. And they go down this maybe S.H.I.E.L.D. is bad road, and then halfway through they're like, oh no, it's just Nazis. It wasn't really, it wouldn't really have been bad if it were good Americans doing all the stuff that S.H.I.E.L.D. was doing. It's just because they're Nazis. I really could not forgive this movie for this. And it gets a little bit better, I guess, in, like, Civil War, but you know, I couldn't forgive it for that because I'm like, you didn't commit. You were so close to getting to the point of this, which is what does Captain America do when he realizes that the way America is now maybe isn't the way he wants America to be? Mm-hmm. And I love Captain America, all right? But, like, it was so close to getting to that. Like, that's the heart of what this movie is about. That's the heart of what it means to be Captain America. And then it punted with Nazis.
Yeah. That's copy by committee.
See if there are more than three screenwriters. Yeah. Four or more screenwriters is almost always a bad sign.
Someone's gonna have to pull out the rug. Yeah. Like, what is your editing style? Like, how do you adapt your editing style for different authors? Because I know I'm a pain in the ass. So I know that everyone can't be like me. So
oh, you'd be surprised.
So, like, how do you adapt your style and what is the point at which you realize, hey, and I'm trying to think of this, again, how this would be useful for other people. But, like, where you go, yes, this is a project that can be worked on and can be fixed, or, hey, this project is doomed. So it's kind of a two-part question.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever told somebody a project was doomed. I don't think I've ever told you a project was doomed.
Yeah, no, you just said that there was less salvageable than you'd hoped for.
Oh, yeah, but that's not doomed. Okay. So I don't think I have ever said this project is doomed to anybody. I will fairly often say, you need to figure out what this book is actually about.
Sure. Yeah.
I have told more clients than I am actually comfortable admitting that they need to go back and start something over from scratch.
Yeah.
Often fairly late in, I mean, on, you know, on books under contract, on books from people who have written multiple previous books. It, you know, it really just depends on the book. It's sort of becoming a habit, which is a dangerous habit to get into, I think. But a lot of times, you know, if I read a book and the book isn't working, usually that means there's something in the heart of the story that you're still afraid to write. Either because you think, and I think this happens to everybody, either because you think you don't know how to write it, or because it's too personal or too scary or too painful or, you know, whatever it is, too intimate. There's often something that you're, like, afraid to write. And that's often, I think, the thing that you need to go back to and to sort of give time to come out before that book can be written. So I do think sometimes there are books where it's like, and this comes out in, like, a conversation, I wouldn't say this to an author, I do think sometimes there are books where it's not their time yet, because another one of those sort of woo-woo things I do think is that when it's the right time, it'll become possible. So if the book really feels, and I think this was one of the questions from Twitter, is, like, how do you know if a project is just not workable? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, part of my answer is it may not be the right time for that book. Mm-hmm. Like, if a book really doesn't feel like it's, if you can't write it yet, then sit with it for, you know, days, months, years, whatever, mm-hmm. however long it takes, right? That sitting with that book makes it possible. I think eventually when it's the right time, you will understand how to write it, or you will be able to cope with the mental concept of writing it or the emotional concept of writing it. That's not something I would ever, like, tell an author. I do think it's something that authors have kind of, and I don't remember if this has happened specifically with my clients, but, you know, I think that's something that authors kind of figure out for themselves through editorial conversations, through kind of trying to write books and having them not work, right? Like, we all have things we've tried to write that have failed and just we're not quite ready. If I think there's something there at the heart of the book that works and that's really important and that I can tell the author really cares about, and if, you know, the author and I sort of agree on what the heart of the book is, which we usually do, it's a question of, you know, hey, you need to go start this book over. And then we're back into the kind of the realm of structure, right? The realm of what's written in this book isn't getting you to the place of really going deeply into this thing that's the thing you care about in this book. Mm-hmm. So how can we restructure the book to get it there? And this is a really, like, high-level stuff, right? Like, this happens, I would say, actually much less with books that are new books, new authors I've taken on, because usually by the time something has come in that's, you know, good enough that I've fallen in love with it and want to sign it up, it's past this point. Yeah. So this is the kind of thing that tends to happen more with later career books, where I'm looking at them earlier, or where, you know, sometimes it's kind of a well-known secret in publishing that authors tend to have a lot of trouble with second books and fifth books, and, you know, later books are often much harder than first books.
Well, I feel with first books, I feel like you get way more time.
To
write the first book.
You can take 10 years to write your first book.
And after that,
polish it and make it perfect. Yeah. And you don't have people looking over your shoulder in the whole process. Because part
fans
of what's hard
scrambling
is
for a book, and yeah.
Yeah, and your agent looking at 100 pages and saying, and reading it over and over and saying, you know, I really just don't have any idea if this is good or not anymore because I've read it so many times in so many versions, many of which were not very good. Like, which is a real problem, honestly. It's not, you know, I can't ever recreate the reading experience of a first book that's come into my slush and is magic and wonderful, right? Like, that reading experience is very hard to ever recreate on a later book because you've just seen too much.
So, and this is something I find interesting because, of course, as an author, sometimes there are things you tell me and I'm like, nope, I'm doing it my way. And a lot of times I'm wrong. But where do you find, like, balance between the suggestions, you know, kind of the, because a lot of people, and this comes up all the time, right? Like, well, my agent said I have to do this, my editor said I have to do this, and I'm like, well, you're ultimately the writer, and you make the decision. So for you, like, what are the make or break things where you're just like, oh, no, I can't deal with this, or is there ever a point in a manuscript where it's like, with an author, where they're like, nope, I'm not doing that, I'm doing this other thing, and it was like, it broke the book for you, and you couldn't deal with it?
I don't think that has happened.
Yeah.
Not that in particular, because I'm usually pretty open to whatever the author wants to do as long as they can defend it.
Yeah.
I will push pretty hard to make you defend what you're doing. There are times when about the only thing I really have no patience for is, and this doesn't happen with my clients, but I've seen it in, you know, other people talking, the kind of, I'm not going to take criticism. I don't need anybody's editorial advice. I'm not going to change things. I'm happy with how I write and I don't want to get better attitude, right? Which is a thing that really irritates me. And the people who I sign up really don't have that because we wouldn't get along.
Yeah.
They should go find an agent who won't read their books.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And could do really well. Like, that's not a criticism really of those agents or the authors. They can make that relationship work for them and do really well. But that's just not for me. Because, you know, I want somebody who's willing to, like, participate in this process where I might say, you need to go rewrite this book. And because I've never really had an author, when I go back and say, look, you have to rewrite this book from scratch, I've never had an author disagree. I've never had them say, no, the book is exactly the way I want. Because usually when I say, this is what's not working.
And they go, yeah.
They say, oh, you're right. This is really not working.
Yeah.
I think that's telling. And for me, that's really what's most important again is it's, I'm not saying there wouldn't be particular editorial choices that would kind of break a book for me, but usually if the author is following their own intuition on the book, it will work for me. Like that's, it's really, again, this is like the woo-woo thing. It's really more about how are you finding the thing you really want to be saying in this book? And the time when I'm going to get frustrated about an editorial choice, honestly, is if it feels cheap. Like, it's not, oh, I made the decision to do this because I really, really care about it, and this is why it's so important to me. That's mm-hmm. that's fine, although I might tell you you're not selling its importance, right? But if that's what it is, then figure out how to do it better. But, you know, if it feels cheap, well, and again, this has not happened, but I could imagine a sort of, oh, I have to put in a romance because the book needs a romance, right? Or my editor says it needs to have a romance. You know, I have to do this. It has to have an ending like this. That's the kind of thing I have really little patience for because, again, I think you're not getting to the heart of the book. They're usually authors are really uncomfortable with that kind of thing. Like, you can really tell if they're trying to put something in because, you know, their editor wanted it in, and it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, I will say, maybe this isn't the right choice. Let's look at it again. You know, that's really, it's because it really won't work if the author's not committed to it. I've never come across something in my own work where the author is like, this is the most important thing. This must be this way. I will not change it because it is so important to me. Where I have not eventually, like, I don't always agree at first, but where I have not eventually come around to, yes, okay, let's figure out how to make this work. This is the heart of the book for you. Let's figure out how to make that come out. I suspect from published books that I have read and not enjoyed, that I will not name, that there are authors who would have things that they cared that deeply about that I would really dislike. I mean, I think this is possible. I think this could totally happen.
It could happen.
And I am not going to name names, but I have definitely read books where I am like, this is, I can see what is most important to the author here in this book, and that is the part of the book that I find the least interesting.
Yes.
And that's just, you know, taste.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just differences of taste.
So Hannah, and we've circled around it, but I'll ask it directly since it came from Twitter, which was, why do you want me to be so mean and cruel to all my characters?
Yeah, bleeding heart on the page is the short answer.
Yep.
It's not so much that you have to be mean. Well, you have to be mean to your characters, but it's not so much that every author has to be mean to their characters, as it is that you have to push the story as far as it can go. That's the thing I care about. I'm also getting, I think, sort of notorious for suggesting that people kill characters.
Probably, yeah.
Seems to come up a lot when I have editorial conversations. My client Rebecca Kwong and I were talking about her second book, which she's writing right now, which is the sequel to her fabulous first book that none of you have read, but should. In her second book, we had a conversation in which we basically created a new, wonderful, lovable character solely so that we could kill him off.
That does sound like you, Hannah. Yeah.
It was exactly, and it was very much like her, too.
Yeah.
It was exactly right. It was like, yes, and he's going to be everybody's favorite character. And it was purely because we needed somebody we could kill in this scene who you were going to care about enough, right? But it's not a deep-seated desire for violence on my part. It has to do with pushing stories as far as they can go, because what I really hate is stories that feel like they cop out. And I think there's a couple of reasons, not reasons exactly, influences on the way I think about storytelling. One of which is, when I was a child, I watched a lot of All My Children, which I love. And I learned a lot about storytelling from All My Children. Mm-hmm. Because, like, say what you want about soap operas, they know how to do plot structure.
Game of Thrones is a soap opera.
Yeah,
yeah.
It is.
Yep.
It, just with dragons, which
with
makes
dragons,
it
yes.
mainstream acceptable. Soap operas were doing the kind of plot twists that are very satisfying
mm-hmm.
way back when, because they had to do so many. And I got really good when I was watching All My Children at guessing what was going to happen, or wouldn't this be a cool thing they should do? And that's when I learned a lot about how you find readers' expectations and then, like, meet those, right? Meet them or twist them, either one. but engage with the reader's expectation in a way that's really satisfying. That's kind of fun. It's also the reason why I never believe that characters are dead unless I've seen a body, ever, yes. Preferably in pieces. never. I still have problems with the end of The Dark Knight, which is a beautiful movie, and I love it, but at the end, nobody goes to check that Two-Face is dead. Spoilers. Nobody checks that he's dead! Yep. Like, what's wrong with them? They just assume it's obvious. That came from my years of soap opera watching, and so I think that's part of where I got this sense of, like, melodrama in a good way. Like, you want to push stories farther. If you have something that's, like, in my perspective, if you have something that's subtle and maybe there's some conflict but it's not fully realized, that's just incomplete conflict. Because there's almost always more you can do. And that doesn't mean everything has to be, like, world-ending stakes. It just means that you have to be getting more emotion from your readers. Because you want more pain and more emotion. And, I mean, not necessarily pain. Happy things should happen, too. But I do think you really need that kind of, like, depth of emotion. And so then the second thing that I really love and that I think about a lot when I'm thinking about plot structure is Tolkien's concept of eucatastrophe. So Tolkien has this thing about eucatastrophe, which he calls it, which is like good catastrophe. And his point is that when you have a story, the happy ending should feel, even though you all kind of know it's coming, mm-hmm. It should feel completely unexpected when it happens. And so your story should get to its absolute darkest point, and then this unexpected breakthrough happens. And makes it come out okay. And Tolkien, you know, being a good Catholic as he was, his example of this is like the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. Mm-hmm. That it has to get to the absolute darkest and most, like, horrifying God is dead and we have killed him place before that can happen. And digression, that's sort of the problem with Christianity these days, is that we've actually lost that sense of story structure out of it because, you know, we all know the end of the story. But, okay, that's the thing that makes, like, that's what happens in Tolkien's books, right? Spoilers. You have to really think, you have to not just get to Mount Doom, and, like, Frodo can't get up Mount Doom, and then he gets there, and he can't get rid of the ring, and then Gollum gets the ring back. You have to get to that point before, like, Gollum can fall off the cliff. Otherwise, it doesn't feel earned. Otherwise, if they're just like, well, we're here, we're at Mount Doom, walk up it, drop it in, like, it's still a good story, but it doesn't have, it's not as amazingly memorable. And then the eagles show up in classic eucatastrophic fashion, right? But honestly, the reason that works is because we've given up. We're like, oh, okay, they're dead. It's the done. They're dead. The soul,
yeah.
It's the dark night of the soul, right? Mm-hmm. And I really, when I teach my classes on plot, which I do sometimes at conferences, it ends up, I have this little upside down diagram that for the three acts, mm-hmm. because they always get worse rather than going in rising action. The climax is the point of highest action. The point is that the point where your climax of your book starts is the dark night of the soul point. Mm-hmm. Like, it is at the worst possible point when all hope is lost and there's just, like, nothing that you can possibly do, right? Like, when, like, spoilers, it's when Luke turns off the guidance computer. It's the moment when there is no hope. And sometimes what happens is some, you know, literal deus ex machina, like in Lord of the Rings, sometimes what happens is just characters drawing on their own inner reserves that they didn't know they had until they reached that point that was beyond. So it can absolutely be a standard, like, well, now we're going to go fight the bastards climax. But the thing that makes it work is you always have that moment when it is totally destroyed and everybody is, all is lost. All hope is lost. And that's what makes the climax satisfying. Then the action is good. Yeah, sure, action, yay, action, great, let's have them win. What you see a lot, particularly in bad script writing, is that Dark Night of the Soul never really feels earned. This is what happened in Rogue One.
Yeah.
You never really had this moment when it was all actually lost. Mm-hmm. It was always kind of, and so it all feels kind of artificial. It ends up feeling fake. It ends up feeling like, and particularly in Rogue One, because I'm sorry, but why they decided to use a digital broadcast medium to put something back on physical really made me angry.
Because there was no script on it. There was no script.
Really made me angry. But, you know, if you've done it right, by the end of it, you are, like, so convinced. It's right there. It doesn't... The end of Serenity does this really well. Spoilers.
Yeah. Yes,
it does. Right? Or does. Actually, I will actually give a spoiler warning here for Galaxy Quest, the best Star Trek movie ever made. And really one of my, like, all-time favorite science fiction movies, truly. But Galaxy Quest does this really, really well a number of times, because there's a whole bunch of... It really gets the structure right, and it keeps pushing them to these... Here is the point where everything is worse for this character than you ever thought it could be, and then, by Grabthar's hammer, you will be avenged. And but particularly the very last twist with the Omega 13, mm-hmm. right? Where it's like you think you're out of the woods, and then it all goes... completely wrong so fast, and it's really legitimately horrifying, and that's the moment from which, like, that climax can come. Mm-hmm. so that's why, that's the long answer with digressions into soap operas and Christian theology,
but
I want you to kill
yeah.
so many characters.
Yeah, well, and again, because my conception, you know, my dark storytelling, my grandmother was Catholic, and so I had the books of old Bible stories for children, quote unquote.
Yeah,
cutting the kid in half and the walls of Jericho. I mean, they're amazing stories. And yeah,
Jephthah,
like
I want somebody to write a book about Jephthah and his daughter. Like that needs to go in a fantasy novel.
They have amazing stories, and that's the reason they've persisted so long. They're really good stories, and humans are hardwired for those kinds of stories. So it makes sense that then we would. That's why that works in other forms. Yeah, I always find that interesting. I think, and again, honestly, what's helped me with plot, too, has been studying script writing a little bit more and script outlines and things like that, because Hollywood does have such more of that formulaic structure where if it works or it doesn't work. Whereas I feel like sometimes in book writing, even in genre writing, we become special snowflakes. Like, we're like, it's just, it's about the journey and the process and the creative feelings and... It's about art. And I'm like, well, yes, storytelling is an art, but it's also hard work. It's a skill. Storytelling is also a skill.
Once you're like, it's about art, that usually means you don't know what your book's about.
Yes, you don't know
it. Sorry, but...
I have to agree.
Once you really know where you're going, you don't want to take extra long random digressions to get there.
Yeah.
Once you know what the heart of the story... I don't mean where you're going like the climax, but once you know what the story's about, that's the story you want to tell.
Yeah.
And Hollywood is efficient.
Yeah.
Really good scripts are really... Like, again, Galaxy Quest is a great example because it's a phenomenal script. Mm-hmm. And it's so efficient at doing what it needs to do. It does everything, and, like, there's not a wasted line in that script. And that's what, at its best, that's what screenwriting can do for you. It's great to have the space of a novel to draw on more stuff. I mean, scripts are a very reductive format in some ways. But that's really what you can get from it, is it gives you the bare bones of what do you need? How do you make somebody cry in, you know, not very many lines is really the trick. So that's what, that's why I push you to be so mean to your characters and all of my clients, really, mean. And it's
not special. Yeah, this is everyone. Every other client of hers that I've talked to, all your clients like, oh, yeah. We had
it's
to start
not,
over. We had to kill it, more people. Yeah.
It's not about you have to be cruel to these characters. You have to remember also that characters are not real people. So don't feel too guilty about being cruel to them. It's about not pulling your punches.
Yeah.
Because the one thing I just don't have any patience for, I've named like five things I have no patience for, is the one thing I have no patience for. Which tells you something about my reserves of patience. But you can't pull your punches. You can decide that's not a punch I'm willing to throw. That's not a character I'm willing to kill. I will not do that to that character. And then you have to write around that. I mean, it's not that you can't have those limits, but you can't start to punch a character and then not commit. Like, you can't say, well, this character, things are going to be really bad for this character, except maybe not. I feel too bad.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They're not really dead. You have to commit. It's really, it's like, I don't know, I'm sure it's like some sort of martial arts thing, except I'm a wimp and not an athlete, so I don't do any of those things. I've done some dance, and I think it's a lot like when you're doing dance movements, and you can, the difference between sort of amateur and professional dancers is if you really commit to the movement. And, mm-hmm. and you can see it. When you see professional dancers, they commit to the way they're moving in a way that people who are just dancing for fun don't.
That's good. I like the dancing thing. That's a good good analogy. Okay, let's see. So this one is actually came from a Patreon backer, which I sort of answered in that, but which was, how come outlines don't always work?
Okay, so outlines are hard.
Yes, they are.
And outlines are hard because outlines are really hard for me because I cannot tell if something's going to work from an outline. I mean, we try, right? Like, we all try, and you can kind of look at it, but you have to guess what it's going to be like, and it's really hard,
yeah.
Honestly. Outlines are good for some things. They're good for getting the basic beats of this is kind of what needs to be happening when. So these are the key emotional beats I need to get to. That's useful. Outlining, like, chapter by chapter, I know I have authors who do it, and it's the way they write, and it works great for them. I find it really hard to figure out what's going to work reading an outline. Because, again, it's not about what happens in each chapter. It's about where they go. So when I think about story structure, it's very dynamic. It's not static. It's not about then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. It's very much about, where is this scene going? What's its goal? How does it lead into the next scene? What's the goal of this act, right? It's always driving towards something. This is, again, sort of being character-driven. So it's always pushing towards something. So even in the level of, like, a conversation, the conversation isn't, the point isn't, they talk about whatever. The point is, if you're going to put a conversation in a book, there's tension at the beginning of that conversation, and by the end of the conversation, that tension has, something has happened to that tension.
Something has changed, yeah.
Something, either the tension has reached a breaking point and then they've resolved it, or it's reached a breaking point and then they haven't resolved it, or it's reached a breaking point and then they've started punching each other. But something has escalated in some way over the course of the scene. Mm-hmm. If it's just a conversation where they kind of reiterate what they know, there's no reason for it to be in the book. When it comes to writing synopses, which I know is something that authors hate doing and
all
is kind of closely related to, so
it,
I have advice on that. The trick to synopsis writing is to go read a lot of synopses of operas, because opera synopsis writers are great, and all operas have synopses, right? Because, like, I don't know, opera fans, we're a snooty bunch. We can't deal with watching something if we don't know how it's going to end. This is probably where I got my attitude towards spoilers. So, like, you have to know what's going to happen. So the first thing that happens, right, when you go to the opera is you sit down and you read this synopsis of what's going to happen, which you often need because, like, sometimes they're incomprehensible. But also you kind of often with operas want to know how much is left. So that's helpful, too.
Yes.
And I say this as a devoted opera fan, but sometimes you really want to know how much is left. The reason that opera synopses are so useful, it's not just that they're written by people who have a lot of experience synopsizing things. It's also because the way operas basically run, you have plot, recitatives, things happen, people have conversations, and then you have arias, where the characters stop and sing about something, right? They sing, you know, the more musical pieces that tend to be much more, like, feeling-driven. And when you're writing a synopsis of an opera, you have to include all the arias. You can't just say what, like, happens, quote-unquote, because you have to list the arias, right? Because people expect to know the arias. And so what you get is this synopsis form that really deals with the emotional beats, because the arias in an opera are the emotional beats. They're the moment when something has happened, and now we're going to tell you about it and react to it. And so when you read the synopsis, you get a full synopsis that's pretty concise of everything that happens, but also of how the characters feel about it. Here's the key moment. Because so often, like, the climax of the act is, okay, this is the only one I can think of, spoilers, in Pagliacci, which is this great opera that's set in a troupe of clowns, and the guy who's the lead clown, basically, the lead performer, discovers that his wife is having an affair. And so then he decides at the end of the first act, it's a two-act opera, he decides that he's going to kill her and her lover. And he's going to do it at the end of that night's show, right? Because they're about to put on their comedy show, which is what happens in the second act. And in the second act, at the end of it, at the end of the show, they're doing this great sort of slapstick comedy show, and then he stabs them in the middle of it, and it's gruesome and delightful. But the really key thing, the famous piece, you can look this up on YouTube and see Pavarotti sing it, and it's gorgeous, but the famous piece of this opera is the end of the first act, and it's the moment when Pagliaccio, the clown, right, it means the clown, is putting on his makeup for that night's show, and his heart is broken, and he's singing, you know, to himself in this aria, you know, laugh, Pagliaccio, laugh, clown, laugh, because he has to go out and make all these people laugh, even though his heart is broken, and all he wants is revenge. And so you can't tell the story of this opera without talking about that aria, because that's really the heart of it. That's the bleeding heart at the center of this opera. And so if you're writing a synopsis, the synopsis of Act 1 is going to end with, as Pagliaccio prepares and puts on his makeup and prepares for that night's show, he thinks about how his heart has been broken by his wife and how he's going to get revenge on her. And what that means is that you have to figure out the emotional beats.
Yeah.
So what you want to do when you're writing a synopsis is figure out where your arias would be if you were writing it as an opera, which I generally do not recommend because there's not much money in opera. But although I have had amusing conversations with some clients about how we would cast their books as operas, because some books are just very operatic. But it's useful to think about that. If your characters had to stop and sing, when would they sing, and what would they sing about?
What would they sing about, yeah.
And then write that
in
the
synopsis.
I'm going
to be thinking about some interesting stuff tonight. Game of Thrones is an opera. Oh, my God.
Wouldn't that be amazing? It's so operatic. Are you kidding?
That would be amazing.
It is basically an opera. There's a reason that soap operas and space operas are called operas.
Yes.
You sort of talked about Sheena's question, but I'm going to ask the full question, because sometimes I feel like, and I'll get to this after the question, but she said, so if a book you're shopping is getting generally positive feedback, but editors keep saying, I'm not connecting with the voice, how long do you keep shopping it? Would you try and pull it and do edits? Try YA versus adult? If a book isn't hitting stride with editors, would you do major revisions or hold on to it for a later date as is? And so, Hannah, I see things like, oh, it's just not marketable, or I'm not connecting with the voice. They almost feel like they're shorthand for something that they don't want to tell you. So is it really true, or is there something that I'm not connecting with the voice? What does that actually mean?
Sometimes it just means I'm not connecting with the voice. Sometimes it means this book is not really very good. I would say that's what it most often stands in for. There are an awful lot of books that are not written at a publishable level, and that's sad but true. And there are an awful lot of published books that are also not very good, but especially when you read slush for any length of time, you realize that there are a lot of books that are just, the writing just doesn't work. And what that means is not, what it means is that it gets in the way. I find it's interesting. When I read submissions, I actually have physical reaction to bad writing. Sort of unfortunate in this line of work.
I was going to say,
If I'm reading a submission where the writing is getting in the way, by which I mean, and it can be a lot of things. It can be, you know, it's jumping in and out of POV. It's jumping into different characters' heads. It can be, honestly, you have to watch, when you're writing, you're kind of running your camera and you're kind of zooming it in and out, like into people's heads and back out to broader views of the scene. And if you do that too much, like, it legitimately makes me queasy, physically. And I will get very, like, anxious and kind of queasy when I'm reading submissions, when I can't quite figure out what's wrong. And usually it just comes down to there's something, you know, you can often kind of go in and poke at the writing and say, okay, what's going on here that's not working? I don't always do that, obviously, if I'm reading submissions. It just kind of becomes, something's not working here and it's making me feel very unsettled. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of, like, this is good writing versus, like, bad, pulpy writing, like we all, you know, like to complain about in published books. There are plenty of books. I love Dan Brown's book. I know his writing is famously terrible.
See, his writing makes me ill. Yeah, it's that one where I bounce against it so hard I just can't get into it.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read it in a while, but, yeah. But last time I read them, yeah. He tells good stories, yeah, he has a good command of story structure and twists, and he pushes those twists as far as they, you know, he pushes those plot lines as far as they can go. And the prose honestly never bothered me. Or I loved the Twilight books. I mean, I really,
really?
Loved
That's
those books.
One.
I really, I really connected with them.
Wow.
And I think I read a lot into them as part of it. I think they're books that you can really read a lot into the characters.
Yeah. It's what
I read a lot into Bella.
What
so
the reader's bringing to it.
There were things in there emotionally about the experience of falling in love that just really connected with me so strongly that I can still go back and just read them and I can't put them down. So that's not what I mean when I say bad writing. Like, I know there's plenty of people who really have legitimate criticisms on a, like, craft level about that writing, mm-hmm. but they work as books. They are recognizably books.
It's stories,
Right. There are sometimes, you know, you see things in Slush that are not recognizably books, is the only way I can describe them. They're just sort of, they just don't work, and you can't quite figure out why, but they just are really, they really don't cohere as pieces of writing or as stories. And those are the things that, and it tends to just mean that the author needs to go back and revise more or write another book or become a better writer. I mean, that's, you know, that happens. I have myself written several unpublishable books.
And Mirror Empire, I had written several versions before we finally got that one out there. So, yeah.
So, in terms of when you're shopping, it really depends on the project. Because I've done all these. I have had authors do fairly substantial revisions based on feedback from editors when something wasn't selling, and then gone back out with it in a revised form. That's mostly, I will mostly do that. I will kind of only do that if the editors manage to pinpoint something that I did not notice in the editorial process, but that then once I see it, I'm like, you know, wow, this really isn't working. We can make this better. And, you know, the reality of it is often you send out books when they're not quite perfect because you can't figure out what else to do to them. And that's just pretty typical. And so sometimes editors will say, this isn't working, and here's why, I think. And if that resonates with me and with the author as, oh, this is what we couldn't figure out how to fix, then it's worth doing revisions. If the feedback doesn't all kind of match, if it's all over the map, or if it's just kind of, if it doesn't resonate with me, like, I've definitely had editors give feedback that either I or the author was like, nope, not going to change that. That would be wrong. And then it's just a question of fit. You know, if it gets a lot of responses that nobody wants to buy it, I don't usually hold on to things for later, although I suppose, you know, you could go back to them later, but a lot of times it's just, you know, move on to the next book. And I've had things that have not sold where, yeah, we've had to move on to the next book. You know, and it depends on the book in the market. Sometimes YA and adult, I've sent things as both YA and adult. I don't usually, like, if something is rejected as adult, I wouldn't usually try to rework it as YA or vice versa, because to me, it's usually pretty clear if the book is one or the other. I mean, I have sent things on both sides at once, but even in those cases, it's usually become clear very early, oh no, this is really an adult book, or oh no, this is really a YA book. I tend to suspect that almost anything that you can't decide if it's a YA or an adult book is actually an adult book.
All right, well, that was the last of the questions, so I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up. Is there anywhere online folks can find you? I know you're mostly on Twitter, right?
I'm mostly on Twitter, yeah. Twitter seems to be the center of my sort of online professional presence, which, admittedly, my Twitter is, like, heavily political these days.
Whose isn't really?
Rather than heavily publishing-y. But yeah. you will occasionally get some decent rants about movies also.
That's true. Spoilers. Just be ready for that, people. Be ready for it.
And, I spoil things flagrantly on Twitter. That is the best place to find me, actually, is Twitter. You can also go to our agency website, which is LizaDawsonAssociates.com, and you can find me there, and that's where there's information about how to query me. Although, be aware that I have many, many queries at the moment, and I am going to be closing to queries sometime probably around October before I go on maternity leave.
So, get your books awesome. Basically start working on your books now and make them awesome so that when she is open to queries again, that you are the first person to have them.
Yeah, honestly, rather than rushing to get something in now before I close, you would do better to spend another 6 months revising it. It probably needs it.
Yeah, having worked with Hannah, I can tell you.
Right? The best thing, honestly, the best thing you can ever do. Okay, I have a couple more revision things that I just need to say to the world before we go. Sorry. The first one is that the best thing you can ever do for your book is set it down and write a different book and then come back to it. Mm. Write a better book, especially if you're like, if you've been revising something and you don't know if it's good enough and you don't know if you love it enough, put it down and write something else, because the next thing you write will be better. And then when you come back to that previous one, you will probably figure out either why it wasn't working and that, yes, you still want to make it work and maybe it's time for it now, or that it didn't work. for whatever reason. But you will always, you'll basically always improve. So, like, always go write a better book is my main advice. And then my second piece of advice, which is purely technical, but I really do believe, is when you're revising, if you can, keep a, like, copy of the manuscript, whether it's on, like, a tablet or printed or on your phone. Have a copy of the manuscript to read off of, and then retype the whole thing as you revise, at least the first time through.
This is for people who aren't on deadlines, Hannah.
I don't know. I don't think it's actually that much slower if you type pretty fast. Because what it does is if you retype it, when there's a blank page in front of you, you are much more creative than when there's like a beautiful manuscript-looking thing. Because we all really, really give in to the allure of like the beautiful manuscript-shaped object. Like, look, it's pretty, and it has all of these words.
It feels like so much is done.
And honestly, like, you just stare at it, and you print it out, and you stroke it, and it looks so pretty that you can't tell if it's good. And it's much easier to make the kinds of radical changes that are necessary in editing, because editing is not about changing what's on the page. Editing is about totally rewriting what's on the page, except in a way that preserves the part that matters. And it's much easier to do that if you're actually having to retype it all. Because then you're having to go through and be like, what does the scene do? What is the scene for? Is it doing what I want? So that is my revision advice for everybody.
That is solid advice. All right. Hannah, thank you so much for swinging by and chatting about the writing process. Appreciate it. And I know everybody's going to, the whole listening public, I guess, is going to appreciate it too. So thank you so much.
This was fun. Thank you.
So I hope that you guys all found that super inspiring. I know I did. I was like very quiet, as you noticed during like that entire conversation, because I'm like taking notes like, oh shit, I got to do this. And this thing, because I think as a lot of you know who've been following me online, we just threw out a bunch of my latest novel because basically Hannah said, this is not working, Hurley. Get to work. Get to work, Hurley. And now you know why the podcast is called Get to Work, Hurley. Thank you, everybody. This entire podcast is actually funded through Patreon. So if you would like to throw in a buck, that would be fabulous. We are at patreon.com/CameronHurley, and that is Cameron with a K. My hope is to bring you more exciting and wonderful topics of the day like this. And also crazy things to teach you more about things and also teach me more about things. I mean, shit, why not? I'll take it. So thank you very much for coming along for the ride today, and I will see you next month.